Good evening, everybody.
Good evening.
I'm Michael Fagan. I'm leading the class tonight. So since we have some new people here tonight, was anyone here? How many people were not here last week? Okay. Good. I think it would be good to just make sure we have a general orientation of what we're doing here in this class, because it's picking up, just taking the actual material that we're looking at tonight without having a general overview could be more complicated or at least confusing. We're studying something called mind training, or lojong, slogan. Lojong in Tibetan means training the mind. And it has to do with Mahayana practice. Mahayana is the great vehicle of Buddhism. And just to distinguish it, we have different aspects or different emphases in Buddhism. The basic truth about Buddhism, the most fundamental truth, is fundamentally egolessness. And in the first vehicle, or what you call the fundamental vehicle, we discover the truth of no self, of selflessness, or no identity, no permanent self. Self is basically a label we put on passing movements of the mind and solidify it into an identity, which is a complete error because it's the fundamental basis for all of our confusion and suffering. We have a greater vehicle, which is basically recognizing not only the absence of an identity of self, but also an absence of identity of other and of phenomena itself. So we call that egolessness of dharmas, as distinct from egolessness of self, as a wider understanding. We're in this section of the practice and the teachings, which have to do with discovering how to fundamentally go beyond the notion of a centralized self. And the centralized self is characterized by confusion, grasping, delusion, and perpetuating problems for both the individual and everyone else. So we've been studying the teachings of Kyabgyam Rinpoche, Tralak Rinpoche, that is to say, Tralak Rinpoche, and the teachings which are based on the teachings of Atisha, who was a Tibetan teacher who flourished in around the 1000 that century. And basically the teachings that he brought in were codified into these series of slogans, and they're found in these two books of which we've been with. Our main practice text is the practice of Lojong, and then a supplementary but potentially more basic text, in fact, is called Training the Mind by Trungpa Rinpoche, Kyagam Trungpa Rinpoche. So, in these slogans, there are methods of both reminding ourselves how to engage on the path of what we call bodhicitta, which is awakened mind. And that awakened mind is characterized by wisdom and compassion. And it becomes the fuel or the basic trajectory of our journey. Everybody following me so far? Good. When we look at the slogans, these are called, the slogans we're looking at tonight are called relative slogans. They're dealing with what's called relative truth. And that has to be understood as at least initially distinct from something called absolute truth. So the word dharma, is everybody familiar with that term, dharma? It has a wide range of meanings, and it's very hard to just simplify it in one term. But fundamentally, the first concern about dharma is understanding that it does relate to something called reality or the teachings of reality, and also and truth. And so when we talk about dharma this way, there are other applications, but this is the basic point of what we call teaching the Dharma, practicing the Dharma. This is what we're talking about. Absolute truth is based on understanding what we call the basic nature of reality, which is beyond words, beyond conception. It's fundamentally the nature of what we are at root. And so we have these absolute slogans which talk about how to begin to understand that. And then the relative slogans are based on how we can actually articulate this in terms of very specific situations and undo our habitual patterns, which constantly keep us from being able to see what's really there and be able to actually function in wisdom, compassion, and genuineness. Okay. I realize it just, I don't mean to, this may be old hat for some people here, but I just thought it's important that we're all on the same page before we launch into discussing these individual slogans. Last week...
Do you want me to just give an orientation?
Oh, yeah. Before we go on, we have to first... Emily needs to make an announcement about how we're going through this convoluted path of presenting these teachings in the first place. Okay.
So what I decided to do is just type up a schedule so people might be slightly less confused. Yes.
Do you have another copy?
Mike will give you his copy. Oh, you have an extra. Okay.
Thank you.
You don't have one?
Sure.
Is it online? Maybe I can just get online.
Why don't you give her your copy?
I think this is online. Okay.
Okay.
Is that online?
No, it was just made up for the use now.
I made this up for today, but Sandra will be posting everything. So we do have a website for new people. If you haven't seen it, walthambuddhist.org, we have all our talks on there. So what I wanted to explain is we aren't actually just going through all the slogans in order, which I think, you know, people figured out by now, but... it's helpful to sort of see where we're going so you won't be too confused when we sort of jump from place to place. So we are now on November 9th. We're in Module 20. This is Class 8. And as you know, Michael Fagan's leading it. We're under 0.5 measuring success in the practice. So we're doing slogans 19 to 22 tonight. And just so you don't get confused, last week we did 0.3, and we covered only the points 11, 12, and 13. And the rest of 0.3 will be given by Joseph later on. He's going to do that actually at the end, because those are the absolute slogans. Again, skillful means of absolute slogans. So this is sort of a guide to where we're going, and we post everything online so you'll see what the readings are for each class. I think that's...
Are you going to give a comment on the word bodhicitta?
No, Michael's going to lead the class.
Okay.
You had something you needed to say?
Oh. I just want to say to the new people that the meditation instruction I had to give you was sort of one size fits all, which doesn't actually work necessarily. And that's why we have meditation instructors. And even if you are a student somewhere else and you don't come here very often, if you ask for a meditation instructor, you can still get individual counseling. It can be done perhaps once in person and even by phone after that. So it can be very helpful even if you don't have time to come here.
You can contact any of us. There's three of us here. One person's sure. Not here. Okay, carry on. Thank you so much.
Having given all that, let's bow to start.
Okay.
So now we're going to go ahead through, going to part 5, point 5, evaluation of mind training. This is indicating that we've already been engaging on the path so far. And these slogans, all Dharma agrees at one point, of the two witnesses hold the principal one, always maintain only a joyful mind. and if you can practice even when distracted, you are well trained, are a means of assessing how it's going. We can actually check in and determine whether we actually are kidding ourselves and just pretending or giving lip service to this process, or actually stabilizing it all. So for any of us who are new and want to learn more about how we got here, in case you decide to stay with the class, we'll be happy to privately help you with that, just giving you the background, give suggested readings, and so on. What Trolloc Rinpoche discussed, or how he phrased it, is for those of us who are familiar, we studied these slogans before a couple of years ago. But they were the slogans that were translated by Trungpa Rinpoche and articulated through his student Pema Chidren, who many of you are familiar with. So the wording is quite different here, and the emphasis is a bit different from the presentation that you would find in Training the Mind, or what was the Pema Chidren text, please?
Start where you are.
Start where you are. Yeah. Okay. So you're welcome to look at those. They're very helpful. In fact, Start Where You Are is a wonderful text because Pema Chidren has a way of just speaking right from the level of where we are in very familiar terms. And, of course, we have Training the Mind, which is one of the superb texts from Rinpoche. All right. So Trolloc Rinpoche discusses this as evaluation of mind training, a means of measuring success of where we are with our practice. And so what this refers to on some level is the experience of awareness and mindfulness increasing in our experience. And we begin to understand how meditation is such an essential element in terms of this path. We are working on ourselves in order to benefit others. This is the primary impulse. We're not simply trying to clean up our own act. We want to do that too, but on a much deeper level, on a much more essential level in terms of being able to engage genuinely in the world, we're learning how to basically protect ourselves from our own confusion that can be somehow led by the fundamental enlightened nature we all have intrinsically within us, and it's understood that this is basically a potential that all beings have in themselves, and when we encounter dharmic teachings, they are especially triggered or stimulated, so we have an opportunity to really explore and learn this in a very systematic and helpful way. So without meditation, we learn there's no real facility to work for the liberation of other beings, because even the notion of what liberation means is in the special context of Buddhism. Do we understand that? Is anybody confused about that? What does it mean to work for the liberation of beings? Would anybody like to offer?
Can you expand on that a little bit? Can you expand on that? I'm not completely sure.
All right. Well, liberating oneself is liberating everybody, first of all. Okay. That's a key point. Mm-hmm. If we're not liberated, no one else is going to be liberated, truly, because our fundamental way of even seeing things is going to be confused.
So liberated from our suffering? Is that what you're talking about?
Well, we're liberated from the chain of suffering, which is basically the causation of karma, which is basically endlessly repeating cause and effect and the repetition of habitual patterns, which are all based on ignorance, fundamental ignorance. Ignorance is considered the root of, is understood to be the root of confusion, and because of that kind of ignorance, it perpetuates itself in patterns of harm, of basically error. In other words, error in terms of not being in reality, but continuously diverging or diverting from reality. Yes?
I think liberating this What was it? There's liberating the self? No, liberating the... And how did you phrase the question? Liberating...
Liberating one liberates all.
Yeah, but I... And how do we liberate the self? Is that what you said?
That's what we're working on. We need to liberate self in order to liberate.
I think for me, acting out of love and compassion liberates the self or the ego. Acting out of love and compassion.
Is that a question?
No, I'm saying that's
making a statement.
For me is... And
how do you understand love and compassion?
Well, through how you act. It can only be through actions. I can't explain that exactly.
Can only be through action?
Only can be through your response to the world around you. An internal response, and also how you act to others. I can't explain that any more than that. Except I know that when I first started this, I didn't talk much about the finding that Buddha and the belief that there is the Buddha inside me and everyone. I didn't talk to other people about it, and I talk to people about it now more. Sometimes they kind of look at me really confused, and sometimes a little bit like, oh, really? That's how you reacted to that? It's just, I can't explain it. It's, it's very personal right now, but I just feel that if you touch that inner light in yourself, that inner heart in yourself, in your reactions and in the way you deal with people, that's liberating the trappings of your ego. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but how do we ensure that we're not just fooling ourselves?
Don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know.
That's why we meditate. We cultivate prajna. We've talked about in previous classes. We've talked about the paramitas of the perfections, which are the foundations of Mahayana teaching. And those perfections have to do with learning how to train in the various aspects of taming and training the mind. And without that final perfection, which is known as discriminating awareness, it's very hard to sometimes get mixed up between sentimentality or just general emotionality.
Right.
When we talk about compassion, we're not talking about being emotionally worked up and going into some kind of a drama over the pain and suffering that's going on.
Or wishful thinking.
Yeah.
Right. Sure. Yeah.
Right.
But I think you can only know that through practicing.
Well, that's it. That's why practice is so essential. This is not just a nice class of philosophy, and it's not simply a formula for being a good person. those things are not... It's much more about inner knowledge. It's about learning about the nature of our minds, one's own mind, and being able to learn how to tame the mind, and then furthermore train the mind so that our basic presence in the world can be beneficial. Harry?
I could ask, does your statement by liberating oneself or liberating everyone, does that connect to our first line when at the end of time we'll say, by this merit we'll hope that...
May all the ten missions made to beat the enemy, or the dedication of merit, What about it?
Is it connected to...
Sure. I mean, we only have our mind, right? So if our mind is liberated, then our experience is liberated. And then our perception of reality is liberated. So that's really what's important here. We're talking about really practical concerns, if you know what I mean. Okay. So, the first slogan we're looking at is called All Dharma Agrees at One Point. Did people have a chance to read the text around this? And does anyone have any questions about what that may mean? All Dharma Agrees at One Point.
Yeah, I do have a question about that.
Okay, sure.
Oh, I just, what does it mean? Because I
don't remember. Yeah. So in this case, as I mentioned earlier, Dharma is, in this case, basically the teachings of the Buddha, and the Buddha Dharma, it's called. And there are many different teachings, and there are many different schools, and many different approaches in Buddhism. It's not just one thing. And that's very important. But they all deal with the same concerns at root, which is taming the ego, as Trolloc Rinpoche says, lightening up. Lightening up, we're lightening up the load we carry around in terms of the baggage we carry around with this notion of being somebody and all of the issues we carry with ourselves and all of our hopes and fears and hurts and desires to, you know, even the score and all these other things. And basically, it's recognized that that this ego problem can only be dealt with through meditation practice. I mean, you need analysis and you need investigation and you need insight. But without the meditation, there's no basis for actually starting this in the first place. So we have two aspects of meditation. One's shamatha. Will you be able to introduce that tonight, Michael?
Pardon?
Meditation instructions, shamatha. Shamatha.
We can't get into all of that.
No, we're just talking about this is part of the teaching.
I gave them an instruction on posture, breath, and mind.
Good.
And it was a one-size-fits-all, which it doesn't fit.
Yes.
So what we have to talk about is that all Dharma agrees on reducing our self-investment.
That's right. And so we do that through basically two aspects of meditation. One's called shamatha, or tranquility, which is basically training the mind to settle and actually allowing ourselves to rest and relax so that we can really be present. Because without being present, there's no possibility of really seeing. And the seeing, or the clear seeing, is the second aspect of meditation, which comes as a result of the shamatha, or is facilitated by that, which is called vipassana, or insight. So we need the insight to be able to understand the nature of our mind, and we need the basis of the settling, the foundation of being able to use meditation as a basis for settling the mind so that this perception can occur without being distracted or getting clouded. Even though these kinds of insights can occur without the meditation, they're very fleeting and they are oftentimes very unable to connect the dots, as it were, or be able to see it in terms of any kind of incisive way, which can really make a difference. When we actually utilize vipassana or insight meditation, we're actually learning about centerlessness. We're learning about what's beyond just this constant kind of focus on me and mine and my thing. And we become much more aware of a greater world. We become aware of an environment, not only an external environment, an internal environment. We become aware of a greater space, of a greater dimensionality. So this is the key point of meditation. This is why meditation is so fundamentally essential. And we also, as we do this and we make friends with ourselves, because we become much more familiar with what's really there and we're willing to be open to what's present, we develop some natural sense of warmth and friendliness. And these, the practice of meditation basically then provides some kind of essential skill for us in terms of giving up the notion of territory and opening ourselves to greater space and actual effective interaction with others. And the meditation also brings the elements of ego onto the path of Dharma. So one of the quotes that is in here for that's in the text has to do with the shedding of ego. It actually measures the degree of shedding of the ego, measures the progress of the practitioner. Interestingly, however, it doesn't mean that your experience or encountering of aspects of ego don't intensify. That's part of the deal. Does that sound familiar to anybody in the room here? We're not just getting into a calming device of where we can lay back and go, oh yeah, just that, let go, you know, blah, blah. We find ourselves often really in the grip of issues and patterns and identities that are very, very, you know, have great hold on us. And so, but that's actually progress, and we need to welcome those kinds of experiences.
So do you think the meditation intensifies ego or just helps us see more?
It helps things bubble up to the surface that otherwise are so... Because the big problem we have is distraction. And we talk about... That's actually... Let me see if that's another...
I think the answer to Emily's question is that it doesn't intensify it, but it lets us see how intense it is.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That's right. To the point. Yes.
Yeah. Very good.
That's the key point.
We're going to talk about one of the slogans is, if you can practice even when distracted, you are well trained. Well, we get into that right away as we discover we're constantly distracted. So this distraction is basically what keeps us from generally seeing the issues and why we then fall back on these unconscious patterns to defend and to manifest in a particular way, because we have these ideas about what we're supposed to be like and what the rest of the world is like out there and how we're supposed to somehow function in that way. So we're stripping away those kinds of... and what we're really stripping away from are the things that are basically entrapping our free nature. The fundamental nature, as we mentioned, as we introduced this about a month ago, was open and free. And it doesn't have, and it's completely unconditioned. It doesn't have any kind of shoulds and shouldn'ts. It's utterly open and fresh. And this is constantly with us. But because of our patterns, we somehow block that capacity to come through. And that's what you could say distinguishes a person who's confused with a person who's sane or fundamentally awake, because the sanity, which is that clarity and that fundamental openness, comes through without impediments.
Mm-hmm. It's almost like you're just, you don't even have some awareness to see it.
Well, you know, the awareness is overwhelmed by the stuff that goes on in our minds and our perceptions. You can see how, for instance, oftentimes our perceptions are just so strong that we focus so intensely on them that we are unable to. They kind of block out the larger environment in which we're functioning.
Mm-hmm.
And so we could get totally involved with, for instance, the perfect example is looking at your texting on a phone while you're walking across the street. How many times do you see people doing this? They don't even look at the traffic. You know, I mean, like, I drive in New York all the time, and it's really dangerous because the pedestrians are a danger to themselves because they just walk across the street without any regard of what the stoplight is going on and the traffic, and they're completely hooked into this thing of looking at their phone. So, you know, I mean, that's the perfect example of how, if anything, distractions become even stronger these days, you could say, than when you don't have so many implements and gadgets which basically are coming at you and throwing all this information at you all the time.
So you're sort of saying like that the meditation helps, like, you know, like tame the mind and give you insight, and it sort of strips away things from ego and so you're not distracted. But I'm wondering how, like, meditation is different than, let's say, you know, let's say you're listening to music or something, or painting.
Mm-hmm.
Like, what's special about meditation that it can do these things that, like, painting or listening to music might not be able to do? Or maybe it does, I'm not sure.
Yeah, good question. That's a good question, I think. I think the basic difference is that it's more naked, it's more direct, it's more immediate. I mean, I've spent a long time personally studying art and culture and part of my business and my worldly life. And, you know, when we talk about the finger pointing to the moon, that's what we're talking about with art, painting, and music. And it's not to denigrate it or in any way lessen its impact, but it's still the finger pointing at the moon. We're looking at the moon now when we're talking about this. We're going to the absolute. So when we talk about absolute, we talk about the true nature, which we introduced with the first topic of bodhicitta, and the absolute slogans, we're looking at this completely unconditioned open space. Art, in its best, when it's mostly successful, when it's in its greatest success, is pointing to this fundamental dimension. And of course, it's an absolutely essential and wonderful part of our lives. To me, it's absolutely critical and quite enriching. But at the same time, we need to understand there are limits to what it is. And the limit is that it's the finger pointing at the moon and not the moon itself. It's just, if that
yeah, I think
sense.
I think that it's without concept. So yeah. Meditation without concept, yeah. Whereas art and music, there's a structure. Yeah. There's another layer in there. So we're basically stripping out, and we're going to the real fundamental core. Yeah, Mac Muffy.
I was just going to ask, so is the artist looking at the moon?
Sorry?
And then pointing at it?
Come again?
Is the artist, I mean, you're talking about...
The artist could be looking at, yeah.
The artist doing, making the art.
When they're successful.
The artist has to look at the moon to be able to point at it.
When they have some kind of, I mean, I think... What happens is, well, you know, when something is really wonderful, it's very uplifting because it brings us to a greater dimension of experience. And so that's an assist.
It's
a vehicle. Yeah, it's a conveyance. It's a vehicle, but it's not the actual destination, as it were. I mean, these are words. So we did talk about the fact that we mentioned earlier when we discussed absolute bodhicitta and the nature, absolute nature as being ineffable. It's beyond words. And beyond expression. That's why it's always beyond. But it's great that we can have all these factors that could help or support us to explore this.
Maybe the next slogan will make some of this clearer.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so, we're going to the next, if that's probably enough for now. Let's go to, of the two witnesses, hold to the principal one. All right, so we talk about how we need to understand what that means. There are two witnesses, meaning at least one example of what that might mean is what the world thinks and what the world expects us to think, or our friends, or our family, or our culture, our traditions. And, you know, oftentimes we're really pressured to conform to those things. But, you know, fundamentally, the second witness, or the principal witness in this case, is actually ourselves, our own experience. And without trusting and opening ourselves to our own direct experience, we're only going to be in a very second-best scenario, in the very best possibility. I mean, we have to trust our own intelligence. And we have to trust our own capacity because this is the only thing we really have. We don't really have anybody else's mind. We don't have anybody else's perceptions or anybody else's wisdom. We can certainly learn from those things, but we really have to experience things for ourselves to know. Is that clear?
Mm-hmm. So someone else may think, you're doing pretty well with your practice, and you may have to say, well, it doesn't matter because I know that I have to go further.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, people could easily try to, I mean, they may have a lot of different reasons for this, but the issue is that, you know, listening to blandishments of other people or compliments and various other forms of flattery could really throw you off the track if you took this seriously. I mean, because you might start to manifest differently and let's say, a higher quality of life through your practice. And people might tell you this. They might encourage you, of course, which is great, but recognizing, you know, we know what's really going underneath. I mean, we really actually understand the fundamental mechanics of our mind. At least we're learning about it. And so we don't want to be fooled by thinking we simply have to conform to some kind of markers that other people are setting for us. We need to understand this for ourselves. Does that make sense?
I have a question, Michael.
Yeah.
So it makes sense. The place where I get confused is there a danger within that? Because aren't you, in a sense, setting up the self in another paradigm by doing that, saying that I need to look at myself and I'm not necessarily regarding other people's opinions or views as relevant? Like, doesn't that set up like the self in other paradigms?
Well, that would be, that's moving into an extreme position. After all, we're encountering the Dharma. It comes from books and other people's words, as it were. We may have some kind of an inkling internally, like an intuition and a fundamental insight. Some, you know, various. We all know ourselves on some level that no one else can. This is the fundamental truth. And so, even though you could be in a very reasonable situation and be saying, "Well, of course, this is where you got," you say, "I can't go there because I have to do something else. This is my path." I mean, we're always going to take a risk. This is not without risk. Nothing is without risk, right? I mean, that's just true. If we're going to look into ourselves, we're going to risk feeling potentially uncomfortable about what we see. You know, I mean, that's just the truth. But, you know, if we were trying to go risk-free, it's not going to work because there's no such thing. We're already in pain without knowing it. And the only way we get to releasing that is by going through it, by actually seeing it for what it is. That's what it refers to. It's not saying, I know everything I need to know and I'm not going to listen to anybody else. It's not like going in one of those, you know, that's completely missing the whole point of what this practice is about. You know, we're not just talking about being self-willed.
Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that was well explained.
Always maintain only a joyful mind. Okay. You know, this sounds like maybe it's a little Pollyanna or something, or maybe, well, you know, wouldn't it be nice if we could all just be happy and joyful all the time? But
Mary Poppins, that's what I was trying to
think.
Mary Poppins.
Is that the joyful exertion? Paramita, joyful exertion.
Yeah, it is somewhat.
Exertion connects with joyfulness. Yeah. There is a joy in that.
Paramitas.
That's right. But I think the key point here is that attitude is everything. Mm-hmm. Our attitude, we create our attitudes whether we know it or not. Mm-hmm. And if we can take more responsibility for that by actually, this is where the meditation practice helps, we actually can examine it. We can begin to understand where these attitudes get created. And we don't have to necessarily just perpetuate them, but the attitudes fundamentally shapes our perception and our experience, the course of our experience. Attitude is absolutely essential. So in that context, there are certain factors that we could consciously develop as opposed to simply passively experience. And that's why this is maintaining a joyful mind isn't about having fun all the time, you know, at all. It has nothing to do with that. I mean, it could be fun. We could have days where we enjoy ourselves. We could have days when we don't, where it's really rough. But the point is, we can be joyful. And what does joyful mean? I mean, that's part of what we're going to explore here in this slogan. One of the things is gratitude. A sense of gratitude and appreciation. I mean, you know, as we open ourselves up more and more to the simple, ultimate, unconditioned nature of perception and experience, we begin to realize this is some kind of a miracle that actually experience it all is occurring. You know, we might feel jaded about looking at the news and hearing about how crazy the world is or how bored we are with stuff that we seem to just never get out of doing, like being in these slumps or troughs, but fundamentally what we're going to discover through our meditation practice is the basic magic of being alive, that this is not something that we should in any way ever denigrate or assume is fundamentally bad. And so as we open ourselves up to more and more of that kind of unconditioned acceptance of the situation as it is, in the moment as it is, we can begin to start developing a real appreciation for the very small things that can occur that are seemingly overlooked by everybody who's got a big project and a big agenda going on. Ed, go ahead.
But I think also what really strikes me about this slogan is, no matter what occurs, whether we would normally say, oh, that's really awful that happened to me or whatever, we can take any situation and really have a sense of equanimity about it and see through it, in that we can always take something, you could say, positive from it or learn from it in some way. So, but how does that not sound like Pollyanna?
Because
like,
you mentioned a key word is equanimity.
Uh-huh.
There's an evenness that we begin to experience that is neither going to be exhilarated all the time or depressed. It's not going to either be going to the peaks and the valleys, and that's basically how our lives continue. But actually, there's a settling process that occurs, and that settling process is actually lightening up, and it's actually uplifting our mm-hmm. experience. So that it's like, oh no, I'm just going to be bored forever because I have to meditate. It's more like the meditation practice actually opens things up and actually makes our makes for a brightening of our experience and perceptions. And the equanimity helps us ride through difficult times and ups and downs, you know, because so when we don't get attached to either the positive or the negative, because we're committing to non-attachment. This is a very important aspect of the path.
Well, I think the equanimity for the joyful exertion also comes from reminding yourself that all you have is the moment. If your joyful exertion is dependent upon your fantasy that the future is going to also be this good,
no, you have
then
no idea.
You are not. You have no idea. That's what I am. Right.
Yeah.
So the equanimity, to me, I think maybe it means that being in the moment.
Yeah.
Just realizing that it's all just what it is right now, and
yes, and but what's now is not simply a little momentary blip that is going to throw everything and destroy everything. It's about somehow a freshness that is fundamental to that nowness. We talked about nowness. We've introduced nowness earlier as basically another way of experiencing this absolute.
So let's go back to the third slogan, which says, always maintain only a joyful mind.
Yeah.
So if I find that my mind wants to blame, then I have to ask myself, why does my mind want to blame? Why look at why it wants to blame rather than simply being joyful, and use that to investigate that. Why does my mind not want to be joyful? Why am I manufacturing something else?
Right, and actually that takes us back last week to a slogan that was really important: drive all blames into one or oneself. Trump or Rinpoche added self to make sure that we weren't just sort of like dismissing this. What does that mean? I don't know.
But there's the delusion, what you were saying, there could also be the delusion of joyful exertion. That,
why is that
I'm delusion? Feeling joyful because it's so dependent on this being forever.
Yeah, well,
and you don't know that. And
well, again, you're talking about something moving away from immediacy.
You don't, right, and you don't know that.
And what is that?
You can be in it, but
you're
not always
sure. What is that forever notion?
Yeah, what is that? Right.
It's a concept.
What is that forever? But sometimes we carry that. Sometimes
we sure
you'll have, you'll have this joyful moment, and behind all that is, I want this to last forever. I wish this could last forever.
Just a concept.
This is
like
really
postage.
Yeah, and so you slip away from
that shuts it down.
Well, you can think about, for instance, everybody's probably experienced some degree of being in love, and you you know, it's kind of intoxication. I mean, there's this kind of feeling like this is what's really forever.
Right,
you know?
Right. Yeah.
And, you know, whatever, 6 years, 10 years down the road, what's that? And I don't mean to denigrate it at all. It's just, it's not permanent. It's like the, it's a temporary experience. So we experience temporary ups and downs. We can experience terrible things, like if you want to look at it in terms of a relationship where somebody jilts you or deceives you or you feel like you've been used or whatever, exploited. Well, you know, I mean, part of it is just really being there and leaning into what is now. You know, and this is where it becomes very possible to negotiate, potentially, at least from what's commonly understood as difficult experiences, really rough, you know, rough times.
So just quickly, so you're saying that as the ego rates something good or bad, and you're just really supposed to, like if you're egoless, you just see it for what it is? Is that sort of...
Yes, seeing things for what it is beyond good and bad. Our habit of labeling good, slapping good and bad on experiences completely blocks out our understanding of the nature of that experience. Mm-hmm. We only think about what is it doing for me? You know, am I happy about this or not? And that may not be, some of the biggest lessons that come are obviously very painful. They're not things that were fun to experience or something we would necessarily want welcome if we knew they were coming at us. But, you know, on the other hand, if we have we start to develop some kind of faith in the basic nature of wisdom, which also is implicit in these practices. And this is a wisdom teaching. It's not just how to feel good about your life. We're talking about actually experiencing and living wisdom. So when we, as we learn more about this and as we get a little more supported by this, because we begin to realize practice is essential to this process, we develop more cheerfulness and we can actually get a sense of celebration of being alive at all and experiencing our path. We value being on this path because we actually realize that there is a possibility of experiencing and understanding an unfolding wisdom.
So when you say joyful mind, yet we sorry, collecting my thoughts. You can't look at an event as good or bad, is what you're saying. Like nothing is necessarily like by placing negative and positive into every moment is not good. So by joyful, you're kind of just saying that like it's. No, I don't know. I guess I don't really understand.
This is a deeper kind of joy than just sort of smearing it over, and making it Pollyanna.
It's just kind of like an acceptance that it's happening rather than it's good.
Good or bad, meaning this is an interpretation we're putting, and we all know how we can decide that actually what was a very difficult experience could have been very good for us. Mm-hmm. But at the time, we were resisting, kicking and screaming and doing the whole thing, right? So when we're talking about accepting or being open as a willingness to just be open to it and learn from it.
Okay.
So you can't prevent your mind from making judgments of good and bad. And you shouldn't try to think that you could possibly stop it. What this is encouraging you to do is to see something beyond it. Yeah.
Right. And so we're learning. The mind is part of learning how to work with the mind. But the mind, we do not want the mind to dictate our experience. Does that make sense?
Well, one example, there's a great story, a Zen story about this this father, his son had an accident and something happened and everyone's going, oh, that's really terrible, you know, he broke his leg or whatever, something really bad happened. And then the army came by and they were hauling all the young men off and they didn't take this guy because he had an injury. And the father goes, yeah, well, and then, you know, then, so it was sort of like it went on and on and on that way, this story, that there was a sense of every turn that seemed like something really bad actually was an opening to something really good. So there was no there was no way to label what happened through ordinary means.
Right.
Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. So it's in a way, it's going. We're talking about going beyond labels of good and bad, because everything's just an experience, really. And the point is that we can learn from every experience, and we actually gain a lot of strength by working with the Lojong slogans to have some sense of equanimity to whatever we experience. It may at first seem really awful, but then it turns out there's another side, and, you know, or whatever, or get worse and worse, or we don't know. But there's a sense of really going beyond the judgment there and just living out the experience.
And also our self-imposed limitations. One of the things that one of the injunctions that was given in one of these two books, I can't remember which one, is the pushing the boundary of what we think we can and cannot do, of how we're held back by our own limitations we create for ourselves. And so part of this practice, with this sense of joyfulness and openness and fundamentally upliftedness, is that we can do that, that we can play more with our boundaries in terms of, you know, actually recognizing there's more flexibility. We're training in flexibility. This is one of the key points, one of the hallmarks of meditation practices, increased flexibility, that we can go through all kinds of stuff and we can actually enter situations that are challenging and actually manage them. And so what I just meant by mind is we're learning about how mind is fundamentally our biggest friend and greatest enemy, but we can't escape it. That's the point. And so we want to be able to tame and train our mind. That was the key point we brought up earlier. Taming. This is the training aspect of mind. What we're doing is where we actually begin to realize we can affect and create an attitude. We can adjust our attitude. Easy way to put it. You don't have to only be driven by your attitude. You can actually check in and review and reverse and fine-tune. So
what about the last one?
Yeah, the last one is very critical right now, since we're living in an era when distraction is the chief evil of the age, in the sense that we just have so much coming at us from all sides all the time, in terms of media, electronics, intensification of what we would call historical moments. You know, I mean, if you go back to, I'm old enough to remember when historical moments were really somewhat uncommon. You know, you can go back to sleep and just wait for another 10 years before some big deal would show up. Now it's every day, right? Everything is like, you know, really edgy. And so distraction is really key. And also distraction is about stress. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the things that I felt was really helpful in studying this text, is understanding the relationship between distraction and stress. Mm-hmm. When we are distracted, we are basically torn away from fundamentally being in the present moment as it is. And we're all over the place and are stretched so far that we are very unstable in terms of, and that basically creates stress. That actually is the basis of a lot of stress. It's just being pulled in too many directions and not being able to be present. So that you're so caught up and beset with issues that you have no control over, and it's very hard to distinguish those boundaries at times, because our minds are being flooded with this kind of stuff, that, you know, bring it onto the path. This is going to be a big deal as we go forward, is learning how to bring our experiences onto the path, so that we're actually willing to engage or use even that moment of distraction to wake up. And that's the key point, is we can actually make use of distractions. Since even without all the advent of all this gadgetry, distraction was always available. I mean, you get distracted by just looking at your shoe, you know, thinking about what if the weather doesn't work out the way the weatherman talked today, you know, and all kinds of other issues that just pull you into these various states of mind.
But I guess, it says if you can practice even when distracted, you are well trained. So it's not about trying to get rid of distractions.
No, but you're using it you're making use of the distraction rather than being simply victimized by it. Mm-hmm. We can turn the tables on distraction. Mm-hmm. We're not going to say we can't get distracted, because I will guarantee that I will be distracted before I go home tonight about something. It's really simple. We all know this. The question is, what do we do with this? Again, it's our potential freedom that we can actually employ here, and it has to do with just how we look at it. Mm-hmm. How do we view this?
Is it saying, really, that you've become so good at this or so practiced that it just becomes... even with distractions, you're still able to move into a positive...
You're training space. Yourself to... fundamentally, it's becoming second nature to you.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So, yes, it is that it is being well-trained, because it is so inbuilt at this point in terms of a natural reflex,
right,
that when something comes up where I'm just getting thrown up, I just use it as a means to come back.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So why is insight so important? It seems if you get distracted and you simply return to... looking at the moon, so to speak.
Yeah.
You know, so that's no insight in the sense of it's an experience. You know, you're looking at the moon, and in itself, it's a magnificent event.
Who's looking at the moon?
The person. You know, I'm just giving a human being looks at the moon, so the experience of seeing the object, not pointing to it, but seeing experience.
Well, you're using that metaphor, so I just want to, if I may, steer you back. Because we're talking about the finger pointing to the moon doesn't mean there's an observer and an object. There is no observer or object when we're talking about this. Okay?
Okay, so granted that, I was getting caught in that, but granted that oneness occurs, then why is the emphasis on insight?
Because that is insight. That is the insight itself.
Well, okay. That,
how would you make this happen without having done the effort of insight?
So what I'm saying is we're anticipating some kind of new knowledge, whereas really you're talking about the raw experience.
We're not anticipating a new knowledge. We're anticipating nothing. We're simply being open to what's here. And you know, as we discussed earlier about bodhicitta, it's always present. It's been here before time. It's beyond time. So we're not waiting for some big new invention or some new kind of development that will change everything. It's actually opening up to what's here already.
Okay, well, you follow that. But it's just that with, for me, the way you said anticipates...
That's not how we're using it here. No, it's not anticipating anything. Absolutely nothing. We are anticipating that. We are learning how to divest ourselves of all of that kind of stuff, because anticipation is another aspect of stress, you know, where we're expecting something. We have expectations, and, you know, we're learning how to basically just let go of that stuff and drop it. So something much more radical really opens up, which is here. Yeah, I mean, you sit here and you do your meditation practice, you know, you're just looking at the floor, right? The floor is just the floor. It's not going to turn into something else. Right? Okay. And so, furthermore, Sherlock Rinpoche really talked about how he felt like this was a absolutely a critical aspect of learning, of a trigger or a encouragement or a suggestion to basically develop good habits. Mm-hmm. That we're learning how to. So how do we get to that point of where being distracted actually is a point of practice? Is to incline our experience and life towards mindfulness and awareness. And he talks about how the two bodhicittas arise effortlessly along with everything that appears. So what does that mean? Two bodhicittas are, just to recapitulate, relative bodhicitta, which is learning how to actually relate individually and work with any of the issues that come up, so that we can actually be present and experience, open ourselves to the absolute bodhicitta. And so that whatever arises can become a vehicle of opportunity, or an opportunity to actually be present, be awake, and to actually experience. And we call this, further on down the road, self-existing wisdom, because it's fundamentally, we start to learn from this as a source or a basis of wisdom, wisdom mind. Another synonym for Buddha is wisdom mind, which is implicit in ourselves and in everything. Okay, well, we're running out of time, but I really appreciate the opportunity to share this with you. We can certainly go on further with this. I know that I have more notes that I would love to share, but I think right now it's a start, and we're going to continue, and I would like to ask everybody here to take these and write down questions when, you know, it occurs to you. If you're studying the text and you find that things come up, please write them down and bring them to class, so that you don't, because you may forget about what you thought about, and I feel like your contribution to this class is critical, and part of it is coming with your comments and your insights and your questions. So please think about that for our future classes.
Thank you.